Hello, and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which three guys read science fiction novels, then subject you to our disturbing thoughts about them. I am joined, as ever, by Barry. Say something, Barry.
Hi, people. Hi, Scott.
Thanks. And Kevin. Kevin, could you mumble something indistinct, please?
Well, I probably could.
That is Kevin doing an impression of Kevin, ladies and gentlemen.
Better come in.
Anyway, that was just for lawsuit and assassination purposes. Today we are reviewing and discussing a classic science fiction novel, Childhood's End by Sir Arthur C. Clarke, published in 1953.
Was he named after Conan Doyle?
I believe, yes, that everyone named Arthur was named after Arthur Conan Doyle.
And even that annoying cartoon blob thing on PBS.
Certainly, especially that. Anyway, so this was chosen by Barry, so Barry gets to read the summary today. Barry?
From the back of the book. Without warning, giant silver ships from deep space appear in the skies above every major city on Earth. Manned by the overlords, in 50 years, they eliminate ignorance, disease, and poverty. Then this golden age ends, and the age of mankind begins. I find it impressive that it only took them 50 years to eliminate ignorance, disease, and poverty.
This is...
In fiction form, you can't.
This is quite fantastic.
Exactly.
Given today's, you know, political climate, you would think this would take at least, you know, 150 years.
You know, I was thinking, and I'm thinking maybe we shouldn't elect this Trump guy for president. But anyway, so...
Yeah, it'll work before, it'll work again.
Be huge. Anyway, so...
Huge.
So I'll start. I've been a fan of Arthur C. Clarke for about as long as I can remember. I read Childhood's End in high school, and I loved it. When I reread it, I still loved it. For a book about an alien invasion, though, there's not a lot of conflict. In fact, there's not a lot of, like, any kind of conflict at all. The plot is basically about inevitable things that happen, inevitably, over hundreds of years. The weird thing is, I didn't find it boring. Clark somehow manages to write like you're reading revealed truth. Nothing happens, and it's weirdly interesting. Anyway, although Clark was unusually good at making predictions, the book does show its age in a few spots, particularly in the single female character. Still, I think it holds up remarkably well. So that's what I think, but my colleagues and I have yet to fuse into a single mind, so they may have their own opinions. Barry, what did you think?
This is my first reading of Childhood's End, and I did enjoy it quite a bit. Maybe not as much as you did. Mm-hmm. I felt that at least a couple of the elements didn't quite stand up to the test of time.
Oh, sure.
Especially since the world seems to be changing at such a rapid clip right now.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what did you think?
Well, I liked it up until towards the end, in which case it became incredibly depressing and horrible, horrible book. as I said, it was completely effed up, basically. Like, I don't know. It's like, I guess because the foreword kind of made it sound like it was this great hopeful thing where aliens help humans, you know, go on to something. And it was just like, and then at the end, everyone, you know.
Spoilers.
Yeah. Everyone had stuff happen that some people, like you said, did inevitable things. Other people were just like, I'll just give up. So yeah, it was like, wow, it was worse than, you know, On the Beach or whatever, as far as that goes. It was just like, are you freaking kidding me? I don't know. Like, and like you said, as far as like the female character, it was sort of like, hey, I'm happy to be a housewife and start knitting again, you know?
Exactly. And I'm glad I'm a beta.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely had that feeling of, wow, I'm living in Mad Men or something like that. And there's actually something that I find like oddly, it's like that, you know, can you be nostalgic for something that you never experienced? It's like there's something about the classic, you know, golden age of sci-fi, like this like 1930s to 50s kind of thing where right. it has a certain character that's, you know, interesting, but I didn't like the finale, really, I guess. To summarize.
Actually, I had a slightly different take on that. I actually kind of appreciated the finale, but the first two-thirds were a little rough for me to digest.
Okay, so we have me who loved the entire thing, Barry who didn't like the beginning but loved the ending, and we have Kevin who loved the beginning but hated the ending. We have basically no overlap on the things we enjoyed.
I thought that you said that you didn't like the ending either or something in the
No, I agree it's effed up.
Oh, okay, I see. That makes sense.
I think it's interesting. So anyway, speaking of endings and things being effed up, it's time to move on to our discussion section. So we'll take a break, and when we return, we shall enter our spoiler section so that we can subject this book to the combined powers of our minds. For we are sci-fi!
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
And welcome to our discussion section. Here we can rant about the book, unfettered by worries about spoilers or human decency. Just to get us all caught up, here is a quick summary. The overlords conquer the Earth. They are so advanced that they just ignore our attempts to blow them up. They quickly usher in a golden age of peace and prosperity for all, even women, kind of. However, they remain hidden inside their ships for 50 years. When they finally reveal themselves, they are horned and winged demons. We're still cool. Humanity under the overlords is peaceful but stagnant. Then a child is born that begins to dream about the far reaches of the universe. He's the first stage in humanity's next phase of evolution, to merge with a universal consciousness called the Overmind. Humanity as we know it dies out as Earth's children ascend radiantly into the cosmos. Anyway, so we can start out with our usual questions. First, was there tea? Anybody?
I don't remember there being tea, but, you know, maybe I missed it.
There was no tea whatsoever in this book, which is weird. This is about as British a science fiction novel can get. And it's an allegory about the British occupation of India, which was all about tea. So I'm going to assert that even though the letters T-E-A don't appear anywhere by themselves in this book was all about tea. Either that or Sir Arthur should have his knighthood posthumously revoked for insufficient Britishness.
Maybe he just drank the tea while he wrote it.
That's madness. All right. So, next question. Was there an awkward sex scene?
Oh, but clearly they made a baby at some point.
Yeah, they actually trail off while talking about, you know, sex at one point. It was like, But the son wasn't born yet. In fact, we hadn't even... And then there's a pause because it's 1950s America and the pages would catch fire.
Small brains would explode.
Well, yeah, there definitely was a whole section of... I don't know if it was sort of like, you know, Clark wish fulfillment or what, where they were talking about sort of like, well, in the future, these two things completely revolutionized humanity. One, you know, an oral contraceptive, and two, they were able to genetically tell, you know, whether this child was, you know, belonged to a certain father, and that revolutionized everything. And after that, it was a-okay to, you know, go off and do whatever you wanted because men are programmed for polygamy, and hey.
Actually, Arthur Clarke was gay.
Okay.
Smooth.
But there were a couple of throwaway lines about sexual peccadilloes being now considered mere eccentricities that I think was about as wild as he could get in this book.
I think that happened somewhere in the first third, I think, when humanity rolled over and exposed its soft underbelly to the overlords without being asked.
Yes, that would be better. The overlord scratches our fluffy bellies.
That's pretty much what happened.
Good human.
Anyway. I mean, they didn't even really have to say anything. Yes. Every once in a while, they announced an edict like, you know, don't hurt animals. And then, well, and at the bullfight, everybody got sick or something.
Well, right. Like I was amused by that, you know, that thing early on where they basically, you know, they're the aliens' first big, you know, well, let's teach them a lesson, you know, essentially resulted in the, okay, and then they finally gave equal rights to all the, you know, the white minority in South Africa.
Yeah, it was a little weird.
That was probably considered nice establishment tweaking at the time, but
right.
At this point, it definitely reads a little bit off. I mean, you cannot accuse Clark of racism in this book, since the closest we have to a protagonist is black, but he actually says a word that I refuse to say in there. He says, oh, the word beep has lost all of its stigma. And just like,
yeah, oh, that's right. People Arthur. Use it in polite conversation now.
Yeah, Arthur, but it hasn't yet. It really hasn't yet.
Yeah.
Still racially charged.
Yeah. Anyway, so those are our current usual questions that we ask about every book. If you have ideas about new questions, please let us know about them on our Facebook page. Email them to us at sf3podcast@gmail.com or signal them to a passing UFO.
Alternatively, you could also mumble them incoherently at a mundane kitchen item and we'll still hear it.
Only if you set your toaster dial to medium brown.
Damn, did I leave my toaster on this morning?
Yes, you did.
Excellent.
So, does anybody have favorite scenes from the book?
So, I think that my favorite scene was actually at the end, you know, so where he sort of waxes and philosophically about the end of the planet, and I just for some reason that was the part that grabbed me.
Oh,
I
mean, when Jan does?
Yeah, when Jan, you know, sort of sees, you know, the Earth basically being burned away to feed the new Overmind components.
Right.
And you know, also there is also the scene where Karelin finally reveals himself to the planet after 50 years. I'm not quite sure why it would take, you know, one or two generations to get people accustomed to, you know, what he might look like after he's not been seen anyway. But
yeah, I wonder if they've had this sort of stealth ad campaign. Demons, they're not so bad.
First we'll have him take the form of a dog.
It's a callback for any new listeners that we might have.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that part where that was basically what I thought of immediately when he came out. It was like, oh, look, it's Satan from space. And like, oh, look, way back when they're...
Space Satan.
S-E-I-T-A-N.
Yes, it's but so tasty.
I did have this sort of brief flash of, would you send two children up to the ship for me?
Crunch, crunch, crunch.
No, two more children.
I wonder how many times I can get away with this.
More paramedics.
Yeah. Send up a plumper child. Thank you.
Yes, it made me go back and rewatch a movie called Big Bunny, this old short.
Oh, God. Yes.
But
could you please send up a veal child? Thank you.
Most new children are veal. They just play video games and don't move much.
Exactly. And so that's kind of why that popped into my head for my favorite scene was actually the bizarre idea that I had for the alternate ending of Carolyn Eats All Humanity 2x2. But I then realized that there was some foreshadowing going on because, of course, you know, he actually is kind of there for our kids.
Yes, I was a little unclear there. It sounded like he basically, look, I'm mass kidnapping. I was waiting for like the twist, right? He's like, oh yes, no, they're not ascending. They're, you know, because I kept actually flashing over to the, you know, the miniseries, you know, kind of while during their occupation.
Exactly.
And I, you know, they kept talking about their dark glasses that they had to wear. And I was like, oh, they did that in that V miniseries too.
There's a lot of similarities between this and V, and I'm not entirely sure of the source material for V. So,
well, I'm sure we can ask the writer. They wouldn't mind.
Okay. You mean Arthur Clarke? He is, in fact, dead.
Well, no.
I mean, the Ouija board.
Yes. I did kind of like that scene. It was, he's like, look, it's advanced. I have some nice, you know, new materials that have, you know, lower friction coefficients and stuff.
The most advanced Ouija board in the world.
Right. And I actually, what I kept going through my mind is, oh, Steve's going to have a field day with this board.
Yeah. I did find that whole area was fascinating. I have some vague memory of hearing about a website where they were essentially doing a virtual Ouija board to allow people to make group decisions more effectively. And under certain circumstances, people are much better able at making predictions of, say, upcoming elections and so forth with something that is vaguely like a Ouija board that will allows them to collaborate without actually talking to each other about things.
Have you ever actually physically used a Ouija board before?
Actually, I haven't. And
that's why it doesn't work, Steve.
It's the sort of thing where I don't believe in it, but I am worried that if I used it, I might convince myself that I believed in it.
No, there probably won't be any chance of that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was sort of like the big secret of the aliens was that science existed, but science wasn't the danger. It was, you know, once you got over the measly, like, you know, atomic disaster, then there was like, well, the psychic, you know, stuff was the real danger that you could, you know, sort of cause weird things to happen. And
right. And that we could be a psychic cancer. And it was sort of the repeated theme in the book was unification of minds in different ways. And I think that a lot of that we can talk about a little bit later when we're talking about historical context. But it was sort of interesting going through it, knowing how it all ends, that this is a story about people forming together as a group mind. So they figure things out with the Ouija board, and that forms that set of people into a small group mind. And that gives them a certain power. And one thing that I found was weird was, you know, when I was in high school, I wasn't a skeptic yet. And I actually thought, oh, well, probably this whole group mind thing is just true. It didn't even occur to me that that this was, in fact, fiction. And I sort of just absorbed it into my beliefs without really thinking about it too hard.
Well, it is true.
It's a hive mind of one.
Exactly. So anyway, question, were the overlords really the good guys?
They're just the lackeys.
I don't think they were either antagonists or protagonists, right? I mean, they were sort of just like the amoral babysitter. Like, well, go do whatever you're going to do. Just don't blow yourself up. Right? I mean...
Yeah, it was definitely... They kind of had their heavy-handed, you know, monitoring, but people kind of got used to it. So it definitely had a bit of a totalitarian feel to it, but it wasn't like... It was sort of like a... you know, beneficent dictator kind of thing. Like,
part of my question is you can sort of look at them in two different ways. One is they are nobly helping mankind on to its glorious future as part of the overmind.
I think you misspoke there. It's glorious end.
Well, that's the real question.
Right.
Is
well, you don't know what the end is. I mean, they imply that, you know, the absorption into the overmind is a good thing, but, you know, maybe that's like what hell really is or something. You know, it's like you don't
right.
know.
Well, that's the illusion of Armageddon, right?
I mean, my question is, are these Borg henchmen?
That's part Silver Surfer and part mercenary, right?
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, are they being like sucked into like the Q continuum or something like that? In which case I would be like, awesome. Or like, you know, is it, you know, are they going to be like all powerful energy beings of some kind? Or are they just like, you know, they kind of implied that they, I don't know. It almost seemed like
look, they're not turning into the aliens from 2001.
Well, right. I mean, like in this case, you know, they said you lose your individual consciousness. So you become part of some kind of continuum, but you don't actually exist as yourself anymore.
Right. But you could say that's like to a dirty piece of hippies food. I mean, you know, is this like liquid sky? Are children the equivalent of, you know, overmined potato chips?
Overmined potato chips.
The other problem is it's like,
ban.
they never even give humanity a choice, right?
Right.
To me, I mean, that seems like one of the worst, the most egregious things that happened in this book.
There is no choice. It's inevitable.
It's like they showed up. All of a sudden, everybody just sort of sat there like dumbfounded, staring into the sky, wondering, you know, what should we do next? And then Karelin's voice comes out and says, you know, well, I'm here to take care of you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in today's, you know, day and age, like North Korea would have no problems launching their first nuke at like Japan, you know, given this the potential opportunity.
Well, that did happen in the book, basically.
Well, once, but I agree with Barry that if Clark were trying to write a more realistic novel, there would be just somebody that just says, I'm going to first throw all the nukes I have at it, then all the regular bombs, then any rocks that I have lying around. If I can build a big slingshot and just fire all the citizens, you know.
This is basically the perfect cover for, like, you know, if this were to happen today, right, Putin's first move would be to annex the rest of Europe while we were all staring at the sky, right?
Well, right. And it sounded like he did address that a bit, but it was basically like, as well, the first time this happened, they kind of brought out their giant, you know, hammer or whatever. I don't even remember what happened now. They didn't really do anything other than just sort of stop everything from happening or something.
Right. They never retaliate. They always take passive.
They're just like, whatever, you know, it's not important. We're just preventing you from destroying yourself on the whole.
And then, of course, there's that bit where Karelin says, oh, well, power properly applied is not these, you know, nuclear bombs or anything like that. And I was remember reading that sentence even the first time and gearing up for, oh, what a message of peace and love he's going to give us. And just like, no, if you just like played a musical note constantly and just drove that person completely nuts.
Oh, right. They were basically like, you could have stopped World War II by making Hitler go nuts, and then he wouldn't have been able to sleep, and then that would have just stopped, right? And like, well, maybe not, but, you know, I see your point.
There's also the thing where Karelin says, you know, it's like, you know, you really don't know what real power is, right?
Right.
And the sort of the, you know, the funny thing that happens later is that it's like the overlords really don't have that much power relative to the Overmind, right? The Overmind has basically, you know, many orders of magnitude greater power than the overlords, right.
Just isn't good at like directly interfacing with physical reality. It seems like they have their kind of Overmind buffer.
But it seems that if you had that much power, right, you would be able to basically, you know, swap the overlords out as something that's fungible.
Yes, that's probably true. It's probably just, well, you know, you do what we say and everything's fine. So yeah,
if I had that type of power, right, I would just create some sort of layer below me to interface with the rest of the universe and know that they're fully under my control and not having to, you know, worry about them doing something crazy like allowing the, you know, the third level down to rebel or something. Or
well, maybe that's what the overlords are. Maybe the Overmind created them, forged up some memories so that they don't even realize that, and just said, okay, you do our bidding. By the way, don't tell them we created them 5 minutes ago.
well, right. They seem to have, you know, like, you know, if we take it from the book that, you know, they did have their own history beforehand, or, well, I guess they said they always knew of the Overmind, but they had sort of a, you know, they're not getting to go to the afterlife or whatever it is. They get to stay in physical reality. And
right.
So it seemed like for a while that they were very jealous, or at least subtly jealous. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, it almost seemed like they were trying to figure out how to get out from under the yoke of the Overmind.
Right.
But they're taking a very scientific approach to it, right? Since they don't have these sort of psychic powers that the Overmind and the humans don't have, right? They're studying it all through science. It's like, oh, you know, we record all this stuff as, you know, as you're watching it, and we'll get to see it as well. And
right, exactly. They're trying to analyze themselves out of slavery to something that is basically beyond science, as far as we can tell.
Yeah.
And Clark had sort of pantheist leanings for a little while, and so the Overmind would be something akin to his view of God, and in which case the overlords would be kind of like the angels.
Basically, the illusion was that they were the fallen angels, though.
Right, exactly. I mean,
there's a lot of Christian, you know, I don't want to use the word mythology, but, you know, Christian symbology here.
Sure. And, I mean, Clark was really sort of an interesting religious writer, and he was hard to pin down.
Even the Jonah and the whale.
Exactly.
Bit there where he kind of, you know, secrets himself inside of that giant sperm whale.
And right.
Takes a trip across the galaxy to go see things and come back just in time to see the end of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I actually thought that was an interesting vehicle for getting someone from the previous generation back in time to witness what the end result was.
Some stuff may have happened while you were away.
The thing that I was really interested in is this is, other than the psychic stuff, this is so hard science fiction that they don't even let the overlords travel faster than the speed of light.
That's true.
But anyway, so as I said before, this is about as British as science fiction gets. You can replace the overlords with white guys in pith helmets and Earth with India, and this becomes a very big and uncomfortable apology for the British Empire. I thought I was being really insightful in seeing this until Clark basically spent a few pages saying, oh, yes, this is a lot like India.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thought kind of going through the first like third of the book, and then he kind of like lets it spill like somewhere near the middle, and he's just like, yep, and they couldn't get out fast enough.
Yeah, and they did have Karelin saying, oh, yes, this is just an inconvenience. I can't wait to get back to my real work, which is something about mathematics that your puny minds could not possibly understand. And then when you realize that what he's actually saying is, I can't wait till your world explodes.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it kind of like fades away into like the ether or something. That part was a little bizarre too, where it's like, no, the people that were left don't deserve to stay. you know, they don't even deserve to like live out their entire lives, really. They, you know, they just become apathetic, and then the world just, you know, fades into like, you know, subatomic particles or something. And so it's sort of like, oh, well, that was nice of you.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, the New Athens people basically vaporize themselves in a nuclear fire.
Well,
right?
Well, right. That's what I mean. Like by it's like, you know, on the beach basically had that, you know, that was like, you know, was it Neville Shute's answer to like, well, you know, if there was this like atomic war and then like, you know, the radiation cloud was going to hit Australia in a few months, like, what are we going to do? Well, everyone starts driving race cars like crazy, stop going to work. And like, you know, basically like they prepare for to die. They don't actually try to, you know, say, well, let's build some fallout shelters, you know, because we have a few months, and then like, you know, in a few hundred years, everything will be cool. It's like, so, well,
this is exactly the opposite of Seven Eves.
But actually, I thought that too, where it's like in Seven Eves, there were seven people left and they, you know, continued the human race. And this one, they had, you know, most of the people, you know, decided to self-immolate themselves. And then like the few people that were left were just like, eh, we couldn't be bothered to have kids because, you know, what's the point?
I mean, to me, the people of New Athens were, I don't want to call them my heroes, but, you know, they were actually willing to go out and try something different as opposed to just, you know, acquiescing to several generations of, you know, having these giant, you know, giant alien, you know, alien ships over them the entire time, right? We're going to go off and create our little, you know, art community and, you know, do whatever the hell we want. And yeah, we'll let the overlords in to take a look around. But you know what? We, for the most part, we really don't care, you know, what they're going to do since we don't really have any control over it anyway, right? You sort of, you know, free yourself of, you know, worrying about what the ramifications are.
Exactly. One thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was historical context, since this was written pretty soon after World War II. I mean, it was published in 1953, just when apparently that was the same year that we first announced that we had the H-bomb. And he started writing it in 1946. So you can imagine that there's a good solid World War II undercurrent going on in here. It's tempting to read it as a plea for a united Europe.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, what I picked up on was that the, you know, nation states weren't necessarily the answer, right? Because this is what led to World War II.
Right.
You know, and I'm wondering if this is sort of where, you know, it sort of proves the point that, you know, absolute power absolutely corrupts, and, you know, sort of this whole idea that, you know, power isn't necessarily like the best thing on the planet.
But do you mean
it doesn't necessarily, it doesn't never equates to the fact that power is equal to, you know, how good you are.
Right. Exactly. Although I really think that Clark does intend for the overlords to be the good guys.
I found them just more like, you know, I think I said this before, that I just found them to be like the amoral babysitters. Right?
Oh, sure.
You know, it's like for the most part, you know, it's like if humanity's evolution took a downturn, when we all ended up, you know, basically being, you know, reverting back to baboons, they really wouldn't care. Right.
Right.
They're just there to do their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, they don't like cruelty to animals, and it's implied that they consider us animals.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically livestock, right? You're basically the overmind is essentially trying to breed a special set of children. Right. They said that they've seen this before. You know, it starts with one and it quickly spreads to all the other, you know, children. You know, things progress at a very natural state at that point.
Yes. And the reason that they intervened when they did was probably because we were on the cusp of being able to blow ourselves up just when we were coming to the edge of a breakthrough.
Yeah. I mean, it essentially happened within like, what, four generations or something?
Right.
Of the 50s, in which case that puts us at what, 20 something, 2020, right.
The overlord equivalent of a long afternoon, since they're basically immortal.
Yeah.
Well, right. They did say the 21st century at one point. I don't think they gave a specific date, but
yeah, exactly. All right. Anything else?
I think we're coming up on that time frame right about now, you know, three, four generations after World War II.
Okay, so
do any of you feel a little different?
They'll be in the sky soon.
Well, we have linked everyone's minds together in a worldwide network.
Facebook?
Yes.
I'm not on Facebook. I'm missing out.
You're not going to transcend, Barry.
Damn it. Where do I get my tennis shoes and Kool-Aid?
I'll hand them to you afterwards.
Don't think that works.
All right. Well, since our merged minds are about to float out of the atmosphere and destroy the world, that's probably enough on Childhood's End. If you like this podcast or even feel neutral in a non-negative way, we'd appreciate a 5-star review on iTunes. You can also give us a like on our Facebook page where you can find out about upcoming episodes. Our email address is sf3podcast@gmail.com. Our theme song is Love Amplifier by Safe Word, available on Magnatune. And until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Yeah. Sci-fi.